Okay.
The education committee will come to order. Good morning, everyone. We will be having, we have quite a lengthy agenda, and would like to start with Senator Metzen. I know I saw him just a second ago. There he is. Welcome, Senator Metzen.
2 days in a row.
2 days in a row, that's right.
In front of this pristine committee. How's that sound?
You're most welcome here.
Mr. Chairman, members, I was going to say with me as the South St. Paul School Board member and the chief of fire chief, but they're not with me, but let's go ahead anyway. This is a bill, Mr. Chairman, members, brought to me by the South St. Paul School Board. It's a good idea. It shares some services, and we're all looking for ways to cut down expenses in many areas of government. And this would allow our fire chief to do the school district's inspection of their schools. I think this is a good model for good government that combines what we did in South St. Paul and West St. Paul about 2 years ago. They joined forces. The fire department joined forces, so it's a southwest or southeast metro fire department. And the idea there is that obviously you don't have two fire chiefs anymore. You have one. You don't have so many lieutenants, and to combine the fire departments, I think they can do as good or better job. They've always done a good job, but anyway, what this bill does, West St. Paul already allows their fire department to inspect their buildings. And they're very competent. It's a very competent fire department. So this bill allows South St. Paul schools to do the same. In other words, the fire department, the Southeast Metro, can inspect the schools and not have the state do it. And they're very, very competent. And, again, I think this is a small attempt at good government where we're trying to combine forces here, and it's not a lot of money, but it's okay. It's money that the school district can use better than they have to pay bigger fees to have other people come in. It's pretty simple, I think, and again, it saves money. It's a small example of streamlining government, and I urge. Now, these are tough questions. I got to wait for my. I think it's pretty straightforward. And again, we're always looking around for ways of combining things and doing things more effectively and efficiently. And I think this is an example of getting there.
Senator Metzen, the who currently inspects the facilities? Is it the state fire marshal?
State fire marshal.
And but, the state fire marshal and the local fire marshal both use the same standards.
That's my understanding. And for some reason, West St. Paul, before they combined with the South St. Paul Fire Department, was able to do their buildings.
Okay.
West St. Paul was able to do it before, and their fire department joined with South St. Paul. And they found out, well, West St. Paul was doing it. Why can't we, the city of South St. Paul? And they're very competent, believe me. Officials, they're right there in the neighborhood. Certainly, their first mission is safety, and they know what they're doing. So, this could save a few bucks for the school district and the school board. Fire department is they're on board to do this.
Senator Wiegar,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Metzen, for bringing this idea, and I think it's. Perhaps would be very good for all school districts to have this authority. Absent objection from the state fire marshal, I would ask for your suggestion as to whether we entertain an amendment to make it applicable to all school districts.
It's probably the way. I'm just wondering, there's so many volunteer fire departments. I'm sure they're all properly trained, too. But what, 15 or 18 full-time fire departments in the state, Duluth, South St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and some others, but I don't know the answer. I think that's a direction we should go in, Senator Wigger, when we're looking to economize and save save money for the taxpayers. But I just don't have that answer. I'd like to at least move this one out today with the understanding that I'll look at that with your help and as we go forward.
Senator Wigger.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Metz. And I would like it. Make a, an amendment that would make it statewide, and at the same time, if there's further input that would suggest we not go that total route, would be amenable on the floor to altering if it did go on. So at line 1.11, I would move to delete special school district number 6, South St. Paul, and insert a school district. And at line 1.12, delete everything in the phrase the South Metro Fire Department and insert their local fire department. I would so move.
Okay. Senator Wigger moves those changes, which allow this to be a statewide application. Okay. Everybody, Senator Rummel?
Mr. Chair and Senator Wigger, am I to understand then that the amendment then is permissive? It is not obligatory? It's not a mandate?
Senator Wigger?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, that's my intent, that it would be optional, permissive, not mandatory.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I missed this. What's notwithstanding Subdivision 5? What does that address?
I'm going to check on that.
We'll check that out.
I wouldn't object, Senator Mr. Chairman, to Senator Wigger's with the understanding that it should be a pilot program. Going forward, we'll look at that. And if nobody objects to this, then we'll go forward with Senator Wigger's and the total bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it is under the current language in line 1.9 and 10, if they may continue to be provided by the local unit of government, if the government, local unit of government has their own fire department, might that not actually be happening now? Or is, that's why I wanted to know what notwithstanding Subdivision 5 is, if it's something.
Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members, Subdivision 5 is a section which talks about getting variances from the fire marshal. Currently, the fire marshal, in order for a school to do to contract for inspections through their local fire department, they have to get a variance from the state fire marshal in order to do that. And then, so what this does is, notwithstanding that section, says that they'd be able to contract with their local fire department without a variance from the state fire marshal.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
It would seem to me, I'm not sure who all, you know, you have small local units of government. It would seem to me that the most capable people of being able to identify problems in that area would be the fire department, people that are trained and are working with it. So I think that seems like a good idea.
Okay.
It's limited. And why load the fire marshal with having to go through this bureaucratic move of waivers?
Senator Rummel.
Amendment.
Let's let the record reflect that we do have a quorum.
The Mr. Chair, lines 1.8 and 1.9 refer to public school buildings between the years of 1987 and 1990 are subject to, can continue. So if you did not have local inspections after 1990, then you need this variance?
Senate Counsel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rummel, that is correct.
So, Senator Wigger's amendment does away with that need for a waiver for everybody?
Senator Rummel, that's correct. So the way the amendment, if you would Ms. McQuay, if you would repeat the amendment one more time.
Mr. Chair and members, paragraph A currently has a grandfather waiver, so if you can give us a minute, that we wouldn't need the grandfather clause if we just make this applicable. So I think the motion... I'll repeat the motion that was given. It would be on line 11, strike special school district number 6, South St. Paul, comma, and insert a school district. And on line 12, delete the South Metro Fire Department and insert their local fire department.
We can clean it up. And then if we just allow staff to make the... correct language adjustments. So, Senator Olson?
So, Mr. Chair, this does, in reading that the old language and those dates, if they were all just able to do that, local unit of government, I think of some of my districts, a particular school building, not every school building is in the same community. So you'd have multiple units of government, but they may, fire departments often serve a broader area. So it's that organizational line is a little bit fuzzier. So I think the clearer the language could be that what is the obvious fire department that covers that school district would be the, or choose one from among overlapping ones to do it.
Right. I think, Senator Olson, I think the intent is that the standards stay the same. Mm-hmm. So whether it's the state fire marshal or a local fire department, that they would still have to comply with the standards. Mm-hmm. And I think what's the problem that Senator Metzen is bringing is that with the grandfather clause, you have some districts being allowed to do it and some districts not. And so what we're doing is to say, in a sense, removing the grandfather clause or making the grandfather clause apply to all districts across the state.
That's a good point, Mr. Chairman. The standards are the same.
They're changing.
You have to meet all the...
I think Senate Research has a... Ms. McQuay, have you got the language?
Mr. Chair and members... hopefully you can follow this. On line 7, delete the new language, if, and insert local. And then on line 8, delete were conducted by local units of government between January 1, 1987, comma. On line 9, delete and January 1, 1990, then inspections, delete. Continue to, and then on lines 11 through 13, delete the new language and insert repealer, Minnesota statutes, section 299F, 47, subdivision 5 is repealed. So the new language would read, local inspections of public school buildings and charter schools may be provided by the local unit of government. And the repealer would be repealing the variance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weaver.
I would withdraw my amendment and move to include the language just proposed by Dr. McQuay.
Senator Weaver withdraws his amendment and offers the amendment that you just heard. Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chairman, how would that bring the fire department in if the fire department, a local unit of government, what you have in South St. Paul is a larger joint powers or contractual arrangement that for the fire department. The fire department contract, having the fire department do the inspection, is not necessarily the local unit of government.
Senator Olson,
or the local fire department. Could you get that language in there? Because to me that was key.
Senator Olson's concern, I think, is that when we talk about local unit of government, we may not be talking about the fire department. And I think,
so, Mr. Chairman, just as an example, several of the schools in the West Tonka School District are in Minnetrista, and a couple of them are in Mound. Minnetrista, the area where the schools is not necessarily served by the Mound Fire Department. Minnetrista doesn't have one. They have part of it is part of it's Maple Plain. It's that type of an arrangement. So it would allow them to have those inspections by the fire department that it happens to be serving the buildings that are there, and they could have that flexibility if you would include them, I think, in the statement. There's a lot of them around this area that are like that.
Captured it.
Should I repeat it?
For the fire department. Okay. Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair, I'll just repeat the motion. On line 7, delete the new language, if, and insert local. On line 8, were conducted by local units of government between January 1, 1987. Line 9, delete and January 1, 1990, then inspections, and delete continue to. And then on line 10, before the period, insert or the local fire department.
Thank you.
On lines 11 through 13, delete the new language and insert repealer Minnesota statute section 299F.47, subdivision 5 is repealed. So the language would read, local inspections of public school buildings and charter schools may be provided by the local unit of government or the local fire department.
Okay. All right, on that amendment, Senator Wigger moves that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wigger.
And I would move that Senate File 1428 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I think the recommendation should be that it be passed and re-referred to the committee on judiciary committee. Senator Metzen, your work isn't quite complete. But the Senate Judiciary Committee requested it. So,
with that change,
have they ever passed that one? That's fine. We're happy to do that.
Senator Wigger moves that Senate File 1428, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Mr. Chair, I know sometimes
Wigger,
we've had a bifurcated route. Where is that potentially viable here?
That is, I think the first motion would be the one that I just stated, and then we can also, having passed this, we can also include it in the omnibus bill. So, on Senator Wigger's motion on Senate File 1428, all those in favor, anybody here that wants to testify on that? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted.
Thank you very much,
Senator Metzen.
I'll try to figure out why the next step, but it's another issue. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you.
Senator Phoebe, I think we're going to take Senate File 1800. And good morning. Welcome.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good morning to you and members. I'm really excited about this bill today. I got moved up a little bit on the agenda, so as a newcomer, my heart's feeding, and I brought my purse over with me to the table, and I don't need my purse over here, so everyone just take a deep breath. And I, you know, I, like my mom says, I wear it on my sleeve. So I'm here today to talk with you about Senate File 1800. And this is a really exciting bill for me and a great opportunity for us as a state. It was presented to me as a political miracle. It showcases a lot of hard work and dedication of the school districts and special education advocates working together on this bill. As a former board member, I understand the efforts put forward by all of these groups to achieve this bill, and also I understand how difficult it is to get these people all working together in the same direction. It shows a big commitment to all of our district, our special ed students, but more importantly, all our students to achieve educational success. A little bit about the bill. The majority of the changes move toward making clear expectations, resolving conflicts between the state rule, statute, and federal law, which, as we know, there's sometimes been conflict with those over the years, much conflict, and mostly it just makes good common sense. It's a really great bill. Knowing what the law means and how timelines will work will save money for the schools. Through the costs, especially, schools get involved with a lot of lawsuits on some of these things, and so we'll be saving some money. This legislation also enables educators to focus those dollars and attention on special education students instead of in the courtrooms. A few key points on the bill. Special education law is enacted through federal law, state statute, or legislatively required rulemaking. This bill will no longer allow the Minnesota Department of Education to make laws through memos. The bill changes standards.
Senator, excuse me, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but would you like to have the delete all amendment handed out?
Thank you. Let's back up. Okay, another deep breath, start again. I'd like to introduce and move the A1 amendment, delete all amendments.
Senator Phoebe moves that A1 amendment to Senate File 1800. And then, members, it's being handed out right now. You can, the comments I think that you'll be making will be to the amendment.
Yes, so, exactly. Thank you.
Amendment.
Okay.
We'll adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. Motion
no,
is adopted.
No.
You're really trying to throw me off, Senator. Okay, Mr. Chair. Now I'll talk about some of the key points of the bill. I'll just touch on a few because we have testimony here to go through the bill in detail, of course. Key points. Special education law is enacted through federal law, state statute, or legislatively required rulemaking. This bill will no longer allow the Minnesota Department of Ed to make laws through memos. The bill changes standards to rules, clarifying that these are legislatively driven. It clarifies the federal 8th District Court decision into state law that the party that brings the special education lawsuit, whether it's the parent or the school district, is then responsible for the burden of proof. The errors and omissions standard applies to special education complaints and hearings. So if a minor technical error, which happens a lot, we've heard about these, is made by the school district, that small task, that technical error, is not enough to sue the school. This will result in less money going to the courts and more money going to the kids. And lastly, there was one piece that the Department of Education did not agree on with the stakeholders, and we'll talk about this a little more in depth later. The repeal of 125A.18, which would leave the federal law in place that says private school special education students shall receive the same financial reimbursement that public school special education students receive. Present law mandates that 100% of private school special education school students' costs be covered by the local resident school district, 100%. Currently, public schools are presently reimbursed at around 73% of the cost. So as you all know around this table better than most, our current economic situation and any economic situation demands new approaches and real reform, and this bill comes to you about both of those.
What did they do?
We did move the A1 amendment, but I need to alert you, this is a work in progress. There will be another amendment that will be added to this bill as it moves along, and we can talk about that a little more later. And with that, I'd invite Mr. Peter Martin, legal counsel, to go over the details and walk us through the details of the bill before you.
Thank you, Senator Phoebe. Mr. Martin, you give your name for the record, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Peter Martin of the Minnesota School Boards Association. I'm counsel for the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I will be commenting on the delete all before you. And with me is Grace Keller of MSBA as well. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Phoebe, starting at page 1 of the bill, 125A, section 125A02, child with a disability defined, subdivision 1 is amended to make a change to reflect language in federal law on how a child with a disability is defined. It's basically you have to have a disability as identified through criteria and who by reason thereof needs special education and related services as determined by the rules of the commissioner. You'll notice in several places on this page at line 1.11 and 1.19 and 1.23, the word standards was stricken in favor of the word rules. This is an intentional change so that everybody understands going forward that standards set forth by the commissioner will be in rule and not something else. Going to the bottom of page 1, section 125A07, as Senator Phoebe referenced, this is a change to place some parameters on rulemaking by the Minnesota Department of Education in this area. There have been, as some of you may know, there have been a couple of task forces that have identified numerous rules in this area, and we're trying to place some parameters on the proliferation of those rules. And on page 2 of the bill, continuing on at the top there, the stricken
line. Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Senator Bonhoff.
Excuse me. If we are now going to rulemaking, is there a cost associated with that?
There is no current rulemaking proposal that I am aware of in front of MDE with respect to children with disabilities. Those needs for rulemaking do come up from time to time. Sometimes they are created by requirements in federal law. In the case of a specific requirement in federal law, the MDE would be authorized, subject to authority from the legislature, to create those rules subject to Chapter 14. So there is some ability to create rules. There is nothing pending that I'm aware of right now.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Continuing on page 2, the stricken language is essentially related to the rulemaking requirements that are existing in the current law. And starting at line 2.12, again, reflecting and down to 2.31 to 2.32, reflecting the new language regarding the standards for rulemaking with regard to children with disabilities. And then at the bottom of page 2, going to the top of page 3, section 125A08 has been changed. The top of page 3, language is added that says that an IEP or an individualized education program for a child with a disability must be in effect at the start of the school year. This is current federal law, and the change is made to reflect that fact. At line 3.19 on page 3, this is a compromise between the schools and the advocacy organizations about the obligation to provide transition services. Under federal law, the obligation to start thinking about transition for a child with a disability is age 16, and the compromise position that everybody signed on to is that schools needed to start considering it during grade 9 and not age 14 as under current law.
Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just for those of us who aren't familiar, what are the requirements of Chapter 14. Can somebody give us a
It's the whole rulemaking process.
It's the whole rulemaking process?
Senator Rimmel, could you say that just a little bit louder?
Be in my mic.
Oh, that mic doesn't work.
Chapter 14, for those of us who aren't familiar, is that the whole rulemaking chapter?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rimmel, yes, ma'am. It's the Chapter 14 is the statutes governing the Administrative Procedures Act of Minnesota. So it's the body of law that governs not only rulemaking but also contested case hearings and some other things.
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, continuing on, I think that concludes my comments on page 3. Going on to page 4 of the bill, starting at the bottom, other than a technical change in the middle of the page there, the rest of the changes deal with one single section of the Chapter 125A governing alternative dispute resolution and due process hearings. At the bottom of page 4, the language there was struck as redundant with federal law, as already has been testified to by Senator Fobey. There is some redundancy in the state statute, basically repeating a federal standard, and we felt that we needed to eliminate that redundancy. Continuing on page 5, the deleted language, again, through 5.22, it was seen by the department and the organizations that came together as being redundant of federal law, and so it was proposed. It is proposed for removal in favor of the federal standard. Going on to page 6, again, at the bottom of the page regarding mediated agreements, the language being removed was in conflict with current federal law governing mediated agreements. There is specific statutory authority in federal law and regulation regarding the mediation process and mediation agreements, and so that language was struck in favor of the language at the top of page 7, which is inserted, and that language is in accord with federal law. It's subdivision 12 at the bottom. There is one additional piece, one sentence that's added, and that is an extract from a special education administrative rule that is currently on the books. What we're trying to do in some cases is consolidate administrative rules into statutes and hopefully removing the rule now or at some point in the future so that we have one single source of information on special education dispute resolution and due process hearings. The language below that at 7.22 was eliminated because people thought it was redundant and stated an obvious proposition and was not necessary. Below that, starting at 7.24, this is a change to reflect federal law. Under the current federal special education law, Congress enacted a number of minimum requirements for hearing officer qualifications, and these changes generally reflect the federal standard. Going forward then on page 8 of the proposed bill, the language starting at 8.17 subdivision 14 has been stricken, and quite a bit of new language is inserted. This is because under the federal law, the process for conducting a due process hearing and requesting a hearing was substantially changed by Congress back in 2004, and these changes are meant to align our state procedures with those in federal law, and in fact do model the federal procedures. And those changes are also reflected on page 9, and they all address the procedure for requesting a special education due process hearing. Going on to page 10, starting at subdivision 16, I believe Senator Fobey made reference to this. This is a change in the burden of proof law. Some of you may be aware that in 2008, about a year ago, the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit decided the case of MM versus Special School District Number 1, and the court in that case held that the burden of proof in a special education due process hearing is on the party seeking relief, and so this statute is amended to conform to that federal court's decision. And then at the bottom of page 18, there are some changes that are being made to the hearing officer authority. And again, this is a concept of consolidation. Under current law, hearing officers are authorized to extend a hearing timeline for good cause shown. And this is just an attempt to take a piece of a rule, consolidate it within a statute, and hopefully now or in the future repealing the pertinent rule so that there's no redundancy. And that language continues on at the top of page 11 in a definition of good cause. On page 11, subdivision 19, the amendments there are made to change the procedure for requesting an expedited due process hearing, and those changes are reflective of federal standards, and so we are aligning the state procedures with those in federal law. And then the hearing officer decision piece at subdivision 20, the language is deleted because it was redundant with federal law, and also some language was actually inserted in subdivision 18 of the proposed amendment, so we didn't want to repeat it. At the top of page 12, starting at 12.1, the language inserted in there comes from two places. One, the subsection C, or proposed subsection C, is a language from current rule. Again, we're trying to consolidate a rule into a statute. And then the language at 12.3 is current federal law, and we inserted that to be in accord with federal law. Starting at 12.14 down to 12.30, that language was deleted because it was seen as not only redundant with federal law, but in some of the language significantly exceeded federal law, and we are deleting that language to come back to the federal state put standards when a due process hearing has been requested. On page 13, I believe the last page, some technical changes in subdivision 25 to change hearing officer from order to decision. Subdivision 27 was changed at the request of the Minnesota Department of Education. That language is language that they requested. And then subdivision 28 there's some technical language changes to make it clear that we are retaining the harmless error standard in Minnesota. The harmless error standard has been recognized for years in the context of special education due process hearings. And the language at 13.13 to 13.14 also clarifies that the harmless error standard applies to special education complaints filed with the Minnesota Department of Education. The last, second to last thing is at 13.16, subdivision 2 of section 125A.57 is proposed for amendment. The amendment is to conform to the current federal definition of assistive technology. The current federal definition excludes from the definition surgically implanted devices, medical devices that require surgical implantation, and so that change is reflective of federal law. And then there are several statutes and a few rules that are proposed for repeal. One of them is a statutory, or I should say a rule definition of parent that is being removed. I think that that's a very significant change. It will make it easier for school districts to identify parents who can make decisions on behalf of children with disabilities. So we think that that's very, very important. And with that, that would conclude my remarks on the amendment.
Members, my suggestion for this would be that we would have this, lay this on the table, and then have kind of an open discussion until we actually assemble the bill for the finance, the omnibus education finance bill. And but I do have a couple of questions. One is that it was my understanding that there was pretty much a consensus that we would have conformity with some of the federal laws. Can you just comment on that? On page 4, section 4, as you were going through, I just made a note here that this doesn't seem to coincide with what we currently have, and that's relating to the alternative dispute resolution. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, yes. There are alternative dispute resolution and due process hearing mechanisms currently in place in state law. They're also in federal law. Minnesota has always offered a special education due process hearing to either a school district or a parent, but the procedures by which you would request that have significantly changed under federal law in the past few years. And I'd be happy to get more detailed if people desire, but these changes here generally reflect, primarily reflect those changes in federal law. The changes at the bottom of page 4 were seen actually by the department and others as redundant of federal law, and so we are, to avoid confusion and redundancy, we are simply removing those.
Now, there was a task force, wasn't there, that worked on this, and the information I have is that there was a disagreement in terms of in this area, Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Grace Kelleher, representing the Minnesota School Boards Association. I served on that task force for the last 2 years. It was made up of parents, school districts, an attorney or two, and advocates all around the table. Unfortunately, that just produced a product that agreed to broad general concepts. And as we started work on this bill, we found that every word mattered. We spent hours and hours on this agreement, reaching a middle ground with advocates on it, and this really represents it. It was hard fought. I could tell you the School Boards Association did not get all the reform we wanted, but I can also say that this statute is in such need of reform and updating that this will save your school district's money, and it makes it very clear what the responsibilities are. And oftentimes we end up arguing about timelines, we argue about services provided, and this clarification is key, I think, before we go forward and look at any other kind of significant special ed reform. The law just had, at least for the last 10 years, I know, really hasn't been touched. And this should firm it up, make it clear what's expected of school districts, what parents can expect, as well as the community, and we can go forward from there. But it's desperately needed, which is why we've invested as an association so much time and effort into this bill before you.
I know, Senator Fobey, you mentioned that this was kind of a work in progress, so, and a very important one. Mm-hmm. I don't want to minimize it at all. Is there anyone from the department that can comment? Yes?
Mr. Chairman, Grace Kelleher again with the School Boards Association. I just want to share with you that there is another amendment coming. We've reached another agreement on two big issues, one dealing with resident students and one dealing with dismissal and the Fair Pupil Dismissal Act, which is amazing. And we hammered it out just a day ago. So we're trying to get that into language into this bill form, and we'd be asking you to consider that addition as this progresses forward.
Okay. You don't have a time frame on that, I'm sure, but we do wish you to do it quickly.
Mr. Chairman, we are looking toward Friday by having that available, so we will try to meet your timelines and needs.
Great. Thank you. Sanderson from Department.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner. I will just briefly add that the department supports this language with the exception of one provision. I think that's been spelled out by the author of the bill. The department participated in the working group meetings and provided guidance. We're very appreciative that the language has been clarified because there are a number of redundancies and the vagueness of some of the state language makes it difficult for us to interpret the statute and try to implement the statute. The provision the commissioner has concern about is specifically the provision about children with disabilities in private schools. In Minnesota, we have a strong tradition going back to the 70s of ensuring that our students with disabilities receive equal services regardless if they're homeschooled, private schools, or in public schools. We think this provision should probably warrant more discussion about how we serve private school students, and we're just concerned that we will have private school students moving back and forth from the private school system to the public school system, and it will not likely be that what may likely harm the educational benefit for those students. So we just express caution on that provision, and we think it should probably get further discussion from all of from further stakeholders on that provision.
Senator Olson.
To that point, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Anderson, which it's one of the repealed sections. Could you identify which one? And I would like to ask how – I believe it had to do with the funding.
Which section of the bill? Mr. Chairman, Senator Ms. Olson, Anderson. It's statute 125A.18. Specifically, I think Mr. Nelson could probably tell you where it is in the bill, but I just give you the statute that's being changed. Currently, right now, the resident school district serves those private school students. They may do that in a variety of form. The private school students may go over to the public school to receive for services, or the public school may make arrangements to go to the private school to provide services. It's really up to the arrangement made between the district and the private school and the child's individual education plan. The school district does not bill back the private school. That's what the resident district does is enter those costs into our system, and then we reimburse the resident school district.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, that is a section in this amendment that is repealed. But I thought I read when I was reading the bill as introduced that there was just a change in that funding. So you've moved from changing the financing part of it to repealing it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the school districts would still have to provide the private school students with services. It's just that the private school may not get the level of services or reimbursed for those services. It's just what it does is we talked about the 100% reimbursement for public school for private schools. They're not actually reimbursed. They enter the expenses into our systems, and we reimburse them on a prorated basis. So the school district ends up subsidizing part of that recover that they cannot recover from the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Anderson, on that particular provision, the task force had voted 7-0 on that. So there was a unanimous vote on that.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The advocates in the school district, I believe, did. But I think we should have the department would like a further discussion with private schools and the impact of on those schools for providing services. And I think it's more complex than what it appears to be. And we're just concerned that what our concern and the commissioner's concern is that she would believes it needs further discussion.
Mr. Chair, is the currently, do the public schools that are providing services for students at the non-public school receive any funds through the general education formula, or is it just the special education funds that they're eligible for, and yet they're providing the full service?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. The public school would only receive the special education reimbursement. The private school does receive reimbursement on transportation and textbooks and some other issues, but they do not have access to the general education formula.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not talking about
Senator
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'm not talking about the private schools receiving part of the formula. If the public school is delivering the service, could not the public schools also be recognized for a part or provided a part of the general ed formula for the services for the time that they serve those special ed students?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that's just not the current practice that we use right now.
Mr. Chairman,
they could.
I know
that's
that, but
theoretically
we could change
the legislature
that policy
could.
As a compromise, too. So
Senator
that,
Olson.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair,
I think
we can lay that out there.
If I understood your question, actually, general education money does flow through the cross subsidy to pay for the portion that's not reimbursable. So school districts do pay by means of having to come up with the portion that they don't get reimbursed for, And I think that's...
But, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking for how we could make the public school whole rather than recognizing the amount that they serve rather than focusing on the child and who's delivering the service and seeing that the funds are there rather than have this battle between...
The one way that the Senate has at least in the last few years, consistently tried to do it would be to try to fully fund the special ed costs. But we haven't gotten there. And we won't this year either.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Phoebe.
Mr. Martin would like to comment on this point.
Okay. Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, the reason why the task force was unanimous on the repeal of that statute is, I think, what people around this table recognize, it is a drain of public resources. The federal special education law does address the provision of services to children with disabilities who are voluntarily enrolled by their parents in a private school. That's a situation where a parent says, I like the public school, but I want something different from a private school, and so I'm making a family choice to place my child in a private school. The current state law allows a child with a disability to essentially receive the full amount of special ed services they would be entitled to were they actually enrolled in a public school, but in the context of a private school service delivery model. The federal law says you're required to spend a proportionate share of your federal special ed dollars on those students. So there is a fixed amount, and it's not as significant as what we do here in Minnesota. So I think that the underlying concern of both the schools and the advocacy organizations is that we are taking monies away from children with disabilities who are voluntarily enrolled in private schools and where they could be better served with children who are actually in the public schools.
Maybe one approach would be to have developed some language that would conform to the federal mandate rather than just repealing it.
We are actually working on that almost as we speak.
Okay. Ms. Anderson, if you look on Section 2, we're going to, this afternoon I've heard, request a fiscal note, so just so the department will maybe be able to turn that around fairly quickly for us. And
Mr. Chair, that shouldn't be a problem.
Okay, thank you. Do we have others that want to testify? Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this? We will have an opportunity to have more discussion on this as we get. We realize that, Senator Phoebe, you mentioned there's probably going to be several other amendments. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get this before committee members and the public, and hope that they can, give us some comments. So, Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell, here on behalf this morning of the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. We're strongly in support of this bill. We had members who participated in the task force, but clearly the main credit for this effort really goes to the Minnesota School Board Association, Mr. Martin as their legal representative, and the authors. Also the Council for Children with Disabilities and other members who participated as well. It's very good progress toward bringing greater clarity to special ed law and, getting rid of some of the conflicts that exist and kind of some of the circular issues that we have in the system right now. So, again, Minnesota Administrators of Special Education strongly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lundell. Is there anyone else that would like to share a comment? Okay, if not, Senator Phoebe, the motion would be to lay this on the table.
Great.
I think we have
somebody else. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, this is on Senate File 1800.
Well, I'd like to speak if I could. I can see the handle. I didn't
know. Okay, sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Please tell her.
While we're relating, I just want to say that we did work with the special ed advocacy organizations, and there are other committee hearings going on today, or you would find there was a parade of people getting up and thanking Senator Phoebe for her hard work in this area.
Sure.
Welcome. Please give your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Richard Heller. Live in St. Paul. Wright Streeter. I come to speak tonight, about this Bill 1800 because it's a companion over at the House at 17. Is it 01 or 10? Anyhow, let's talk to Mr. Newton over there. He's the author of that bill. I had left a handout just during this meeting. I hope everybody got it. And I'll take that as a yes.
Yes, I think it has been handed out.
Just to let you know, that first page there, I'd like to have given to the public. First of all, I was hoping, like when I go to school board meetings, there's an overhead and I can just be multi-model because people with learning disabilities need that. But there isn't one here. They said I had to make arrangements for that. I was unaware, and I apologize for the public. And copies are available for these, but these are all public websites. Anyhow, if I could start on the first page, that's the Minnesota Star. I believe that's supported by the state for funding. But I was looking because I have a learning disability myself, and I was looking at print disability. So I Googled the site, and I can't, on the front page, and I can't find it. So the back page is just more of the same. The next page, again, is more of the same, but I just segmented out under informational referral. And the reason I'm talking, I guess, is this specific area under what is assistive technology. They're defining under the area I marked there, under IDEA defines an assistive technology device. I'm glad to see that the state is endorsing that in 1701 and in this bill. I do have one concern that since they're dropping off the cochlear implant, that at least policy in the state would consider the mapping and the adjustment in the classroom for services. Because once you take something away, it needs to be defined. Also, if you go down to the next area, under IDEA legal definition of technology service, this is the piece. Basically, I'm asking Mrs. Anderson, my representative, perhaps to consider that, or this committee to consider that. I think Mr. Stump, is it Stumper or Stump?
Stump.
Stump, excuse me, that he would consider that, adding that definition, since 21st century technology allows people to access text, and that's according to NIMAS. So again, I'm asking that language be considered as a new definition. I don't think you find any opposition from the other disability groups, because it's my understanding, even though print disability, at one point, I believe the state website, Mr. Larson's letter, Mr. Newton's got some of this data. It talks about print disability being organic. But then the state of Minnesota website takes you to a hyperlink over in the University of Minnesota. It's the NOCE, I believe, if not right, but it's a research development that's currently developing the AAMCA for special ed upper 2% protocol. Anyhow, same group. Anyhow, they kind of say it's not organic in their literature, but it takes you to go in the four hyperlinks to get it. Again, it's all about universal design. Kids that need to access, again, I can't say that enough, that could be also considered to be put in the definition. Access for ADA is very important. when all these online schools going on and these kids are being multi-model, there's issues with that. They can flunk these tests. You know that you're triangulating data now with MCA growth models with district-wide criterion growth levels. It's an important piece for No Child Left Behind. That's why No Child Left Behind 1111 specifically addresses that and gave the flexibility for states to show that three pieces of information, included added value, will add to this for triangulation. So it's important that you consider technology, because when you're placing kids on technology to access this stuff, it's important that they all be considered. And again, it's all about accessibility and freedom and ease. And I never could advocate for my son if I didn't have a technology piece. Another concern, next page. This is the MSCOD, Minnesota State Council of Disability, another website I looked at this morning. I Google searched that. No such thing as print disability, as you can see. Concerning, because if a parent doesn't know nothing about it, how are they ever going to know? Again, another agency that's funded by the state. Next page, number 5. I'm sorry about not telling you what page I'm on. Hyperlinked from a star, okay? That page, if you flip it over, it's page 6. And it talks about print disability, but where's really the definition? Again, like I shared again, it's all about multi-model, about access, freedom. This is all they have to say about it. People with print disability, that's all it says. Again, as you know, funding has been pushed into this department for kids of special needs that have been targeted. I find it odd and unusual. That's all I can find. Next page. This goes, page 7 is Public Law 101 or 364, Congress 108th, House Rule 4278. There's 7 and 8 is part of that. Again, first page 7 I marked about my concern about how policies and practice and procedures are important in technology and device services. Again, that's the purpose of the Act, as I noted on that page. Then I'm going to page 8. Talks about, under number 5, assistive technology services. Now, here's the definition. The term assistive technology service, by any means, is direct assistance in individual disability, inspection, acquisition, or the use of assistive technology such. Of course, there's evaluations that sort that out. The important piece, again, access. Freedom of access, it's important. Kids need to have FAPE. You put a lot of pressure on all this online schooling, but unless you really get a handle on technology, I don't know where you're going with data that's meaningful and that's measurable. It's important to know that. Again, if you look at the STAR report, if you just briefly go back, there is a discrepancy in the STAR report. I thought those people might want to know. On page 1 of this document, they had listed 108.364 in the first paragraph, but when you go to the one of the other pages, they got 101 and 407. My guess, that's probably the amended. You might ask them to correct that. It's misleading to the public. Last but least, page 9 and 10. This comes from the public regional hearing on negotiations and rulemaking, United States Department, Wednesday, October 15, 2008. They had a discussion, huge document. I have reading issues. I just took the 2 pages. This timely thing right now talks about timely manner. Again, that's got to do with NIMAS and getting, again, print to people. And I'm having nothing but difficulty in the largest district in the state on this. It's one of the reasons I'm up here, frankly. Anyhow, enter post-secondary education. Again, here we get into the whole meaning about access, about freedom, about usability. It's important. They're struggling with it. You'll see that in this document. They're trying to redefine it for all people of LD, whoever it is. It's a disability. I'd ask that it be put on with the 13 disabilities. It's a global thing. It's about access. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. And I'm sure Senator Phoebe is open to ideas and stuff that you brought up. So thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Senator Phoebe.
There's somebody behind you.
Oh, there's someone right behind you. That
one. Excuse me, one more.
Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, my name is Kim Kang, and I am the chair of the Coalition for the Children with Disabilities. And I just wanted to briefly address some of Mr. Heller's concerns, particularly about the assistive technology device, which is on 13.16. The Coalition, and we did have quite a few members actually participate in the task force for the Coalition, supports the federal language. I've talked to Mr. Heller about this, and I'm hoping there's another mechanism to address his mapping concerns, but we have tried really hard to look at the federal legislation and get the language aligned there as much as possible to make it easier for school districts. So we do support leaving this language as is, as the federal language. And that's my only comment.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And Senator Phoebe?
With that, if there are no other questions, I'd like to move the bill, Mr. Chairperson.
As I mentioned earlier, since we do have you, I think you mentioned you had some amendments that may come up. The motion would be to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Finance Bill.
Great. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nowitzki?
Well, Mr. Chair, there may be a desire on the part of the Judiciary Committee to see the burden of proof language.
Okay. I haven't. Have you just heard that?
This wasn't. Yeah.
Well, we will check, I guess. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize I was late this morning, but I just want to make sure I'm. Just one question, just so I'm up to speed here. Senator Phoebe, maybe you can help me with this issue of the cochlear implants. Why do we want to not cover those? To conform with federal law, the other the line that was referred to by both of the Mr. Heller and the last speaker as well.
Sure. Senator Phoebe or Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, the federal law was changed in 2004 to specifically exclude surgically implanted devices with the intent, I think, to specifically exclude cochlear implants. And this is a continuation of a line of thinking of where does medical service begin and end, and where does educational related services and supports begin and end. And at some point, Congress decided that they were going to say that anything that would require a doctor to install or implant or to make useful for a child would not be within the realm of special education law as an assistive technology device or a related service under special education law. So the amendment in this bill is consistent with the determination made by Congress on that issue. There's simply a line where medical services begin and end and where educational related services begin and end, and that's where the choice was made.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then is the assumption that those types of devices would be covered by medical insurance?
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the expectation was, but I can't really speak to that issue, Senator. I believe that it would be.
Okay. Senator Phoebe, I think the motion would be to lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Education Finance Bill. We don't know if the Judiciary Committee is wanting it or not, so.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we can follow through on that, too, with Judiciary.
All right. Any other comments? Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just briefly on follow-up on Senator Rummel's question, which I think is very important on, you know, the coverage. You know, cochlear implants may or may not be covered, and I had carried legislation in the past on this. Just as young people needing hearing aids, it may or may not be covered. And it was a uphill battle to have that covered, and they're still being excluded. So it's a great challenge.
Senator Phoebe.
Mr. Chair, if I could briefly speak to that issue, please. Kim Kang, again, with the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. Yes, cochlear implants, they would have to be covered by medical health care. And this was changed, as mentioned, in federal law. You know, so it's not considered an educational, I guess, requirement under assistive technology.
Okay. Senator Phoebe.
Okay, Mr. Chair,
on
I really
appreciate
I move that Senate File 1800 be laid on the table for possible inclusion into the K-12 omnibus bill.
All right. On Senator Phoebe's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Thank you,
Thank
Senator
you, Mr.
Phoebe.
Chair.
Next, we have Senator Saltzman, Senate File 867. Members, there was, you'll find inside your packets written testimony on Senator Saltzman's proposal, and that is to try to facilitate the time on this particular bill. And so if you look, you'll see that inside your packet. So Senator Saltzman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I want to thank the subcommittee that has worked very hard over the past 4 months on the Charter School Working Group. I want to thank, first of all, Senator Wieger for giving me the opportunity to chair this committee, and to also thank Senators Rummel, Bonhoeff, Han, and Olson for their work in both working with the House during the interim and then following up with a number of hearings. And there's obviously people in this room as well who have been involved in those and the many stakeholder groups. And I do want to acknowledge that throughout this we've had a very spirited debate, but I also want to acknowledge that there's been a real commitment to work together on this issue. And so I think that that's very important. It has been a journey. We started out with hearing from a number of different stakeholder groups on some of the issues. We heard from Judy Randall, who is with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, on recent reports. That was very important. There were about probably 5 or 6 bills introduced this session on charter schools, basically taking the same section, 124D.10, and really bringing forth some different proposals. So we have heard all of those bills. And then in addition to that, the bill before you, which is Senate File 867, which really started out with the department language, we've amended and really plucked some things from many of those bills and also included provisions that came to us from different stakeholder groups that were not in legislation prior to this bill, and trying to address some of the concerns and also the opportunities before us. I do want to note that obviously charter schools have received a lot of press lately, and Minnesota can be very proud that we were the birthplace of charter schools in 1991. And I'm very proud of the fact that my school district, the Stillwater District, was one of the first districts to sponsor a charter school in Minnesota, and they still have a very good relationship with that school today as their sponsor. In the meantime, we've expanded to about 151 charter schools, and we've been a leader. And so when the president talks about that he is very supportive of charter schools, I think we need to also look at the fact that his vision of charter schools is probably the model in the Chicago School District. And that school district, I will note, is the sponsor of all of its charter schools, which has strong oversight, strong accountability. And over the past 15 years, we have expanded the list of people and groups who can sponsor charter schools, expanding to nonprofits and higher education institutes. And I have been frustrated, as have others, that over the past few years, as we've suggested, maybe it's time for us to sort of reflect on where we are 15 years later. We certainly were a leader, but what's happening in other states with charter schools? And I think by not stepping in and having a good conversation about where could we strengthen oversight, where might there be greater accountability, we perhaps have failed our charter schools in that we have allowed some things to happen that maybe we should have taken care of, a few years ago. So some of the stories that have been very disturbing to the public about fiscal management, oversight issues, student performance issues, are things that we did not dwell on in our working group. We heard some of the stories, but we didn't bring in people to just talk about the problems. We listened very carefully to the schools who are doing really great things in Minnesota, and those are the models that we want. So how do we strengthen our charter school laws? So with that, I guess I would like to ask Ms. McQuay if she would go through the bill. We have the A9 amendment, and I just want to give you a little background of at our last working group meeting, I did bring forth an author's amendment and tried to bring together some different things. And we put those ideas on the table. And as I presented that bill, I mentioned to people, this is a menu of options. Here are many of the proposals that were brought to us. They were brought to us from charter schools. They were brought to us from sponsors. They were brought to us from parents, from school districts, and also from different community members. And we really had a broad array of those. And putting those on the table generated some really good discussion and I think facilitated bringing everyone to the table to have some really good discussions over, I think, about the past 2 weeks. I think it's been out there about 2 weeks. I've had meetings in my office where I brought together leaders from superintendent groups and charter school directors. I've met with the associations and trying to come together with some good compromise language. I will suggest that no one is going to ever find this bill perfect because there's many different interests here. And I hope that this committee, in listening to the bill, will acknowledge that this bill is not just about charter schools. It's about making sure that all children in Minnesota have the highest quality education, that we support innovation in the future as we move forward. So with that, maybe Ms. McQuay, should I move the A9 amendment, Mr. Chair?
Senator Saltzman, what I'm wondering about is, does this legislation allow the charter school students to participate in athletics and extracurricular activities in public schools?
No. Mr. Chair, thank you for that topic. That bill, that is not in this bill. That is a different issue that we could certainly have some discussion on. That's not on the agenda for today, but I know it's a topic that always fills up this room as well.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll go through the A9 amendment and I'll try and point out changes from the subcommittee report. Section 1 increases the purposes that charter schools have to fulfill. The list was an or list and it was changed to an and list. Paragraph B expands upon the subcommittee report and includes or replace. And then Section 2 is the Charter School Advisory Council and makes it so that the Charter School Advisory Council advises the commissioner on things related to sponsoring charter schools. Also different from the subcommittee report is that on line 21 on page 2 that the Advisory Council shall recommend to the commissioner and the legislature an organizational model to give state-level leadership to new school planning. Section 3... The change from this defines application and affidavit. These were used throughout the charter school legislation from the beginning, and they're just defined here. It also lists the organizations that may sponsor, and that one would be a school board, and this is no change, intermediate school district, education or education district, and then two, a charitable organization, and this would exclude a non-public sectarian or religious institution, and lists criteria that that organization must meet. Three is the private college, and then four is that a nonprofit corporation under sections 501c6 is also allowed to sponsor a school that's already been operated. And then different from the subcommittee report, this number four also includes a section, an organization exempt from section 501c3. May sponsor one or more charter schools if the charter school has operated for at least 3 years, or the organization that has previously sponsored schools under this subdivision and has been incorporated in the state of Minnesota for at least 20 years. This exemption under four was originally for chambers, but there was a concern under number two that sponsors like the Volunteers of America and YMCA and Islamic World Relief would not fall under number two, and so this exemption and four helps to include them there. Also different from the subcommittee report is number five on lines 3.32, that it would be no more than two single-purpose sponsors approved by the commissioner. And then paragraph C at the top of page four goes on to list what the criteria is that the commissioner must approve a sponsor. And this language is different, again, from the subcommittee report. And is slightly more expansive. And then paragraph D on page 5.5 requires the sponsor to participate in training. And paragraph E requires that a sponsor that chartered a school before August 1 of 2009 must apply to the commissioner by June 30th, 2011 to continue as a sponsor. This language was included in the subcommittee report, but the date was changed from 2012 to 2011. And then paragraph F requires the commissioner to review the sponsor's performance every 5 years. Paragraph G requires or allows the commissioner to take corrective action against the sponsor. Section 4 elaborates on the formation of a school once a charter school sponsor is approved. And I don't believe there were any major changes here from the subcommittee report.
Could you explain? Some of the members haven't been on that.
I think we'll have Ms. McQuay actually explain the legislation as she goes through it, and then once we get through this, then we'll take some questions.
Paragraph B at the top of page 6 requires sponsors to file a separate affidavit for each charter school it intends to charter, and then sets forth the approval process for that, and then allows paragraph C allows the sponsor to prevent a school from opening even though they're approved for reasons that the sponsor deems they're not ready. Paragraph D goes on to define the board members of the initial board members, and then defines the voters eligible to elect the members of the school board. Paragraph C requires the school board member attend department training within 3 months of being seated and complete that training within 12 months of being seated. Paragraph F requires that the ongoing board be elected by its third year of operation, and then requires that the charter school board of directors be composed of five members that include at least a licensed teacher, a charter school parent or guardian, and an interested community member. This is different from how it left the subcommittee. There was a cap set on this, the number of teachers that sit on the board of directors to not be the majority, and this was changed here.
Mr. Chair.
I think it would be, if you, it would be nice to get through the whole amendment first and then ask questions. So just make some notes and in the margins.
Paragraph 8, Mr. Chair, paragraph H deals with the conflicts of interest language between the sponsor and the charter school and allows the commissioner to terminate a contract if the commissioner determines that the arrangement is illegal. Paragraph I says that there must be a supplemental affidavit for expansion of the school by grade or by site and lists the requirements that the charter school must identify to the commissioner for approval for that expansion. On page 8, line 22, requires the commissioner to review and comment on that supplemental affidavit within 30 business days. Paragraph K prohibits a charter school from opening in a consolidated district for at least 36 months after the consolidation or dissolution. And then allows, this is different from how it left subcommittee for those members that were on the subcommittee. Included is also on lines 30 and 31, unless the school board of the school district in which the charter school would be located gives the sponsor written approval to do so. Paragraph L prohibits a new charter school from opening within a 1 mile radius of a public school that closed for at least 36 months. And this also includes that that language that says unless the school board of the school district in which the charter school would be located gives the sponsor written approval to do so. Paragraph M on the top of page 9, how it left the subcommittee, paragraph M was a cap on the total number of charter schools through 2011, and that language was stricken and replaced with a waiver process, which allows the commissioner to waive the prohibitions in paragraph K and L and requires the commissioner to do so within 45 business days of the request of the waiver. Section 5 is the conflict of interest language, and this was the language here is different from how it left subcommittee, and it conforms to the House language and the recommendations of the legislative auditor to deal with conflicts of interest between the school board and the charter school and the sponsor. Section 6 on page 10 clarifies that the board here that is spoken of is the board of an independent or special school district. Section 7 outlines the charter school contract and what must be included in the charter school contract that the sponsor submits to the commissioner. And that would, those are listed in 1 through 9 there. Oh, excuse me, 1 through 12. And 12 is the, also included in the charter school contract is the plan for an orderly closing. Section 8 is fairly technical. It just requires that the commissioner receive an audit report and strikes management letter to conform with what is submitted. Section 9 clarifies what rules and statutes apply to charter schools, that they must be stated explicitly, otherwise they do not apply to charter schools. Section 10 are the federal, state, and local requirements to which a charter school must meet. And those would be include in paragraph A, the federal health and safety requirements applicable to districts. Paragraph B requires that the charter schools comply with statewide accountability requirements. On 28 and 29 requires that charter school students be released for religious instruction. And then on page 13, lines 13 to 15, this would go along with the conflict of interest language. This was language that was for school independent school boards and special school boards, and this would, striking this language would make it conform to the language that was inserted in the previous conflict of interest section. There was conflicts here between what a charter school should follow, and so that's clarified in the conflict of interest section. Paragraph L requires the charter school to comply with all of Chapter 13 and 13D instead of just 13.32. Lines 27 and 28 requires that charter schools offering online courses comply with the online learning section. And then paragraph O requires the charter school to be subject to Chapter 181. Section 11 requires that the commissioner reduce the charter school's aid if a charter school board fails to correct a violation under this section. Section 12 is the admission requirements, and as it left the subcommittee, the language on 14.7 to 14.10 was reinserted. This was stricken again, and the language instead would read, residents of a specific geographic area when the school serves low-income students at risk of academic failure. It also requires the charter school to develop and publish a lottery process that it must use when accepting pupils by lot. It requires that charter schools not establish any criteria or requirements for admissions that are inconsistent with the section that limits admission to pupils and not limit admission to pupils based on certain criteria. And it requires that charter schools not distribute services or goods of value to students, parents, or guardians as an inducement term or condition of enrolling the student in the charter school. Section 13 is the employment section, and here there was, as it left subcommittee, a requirement that licensure be created for administrative personnel, and this was changed to read that the page 15, line 16, beginning there, that the board of directors shall establish qualifications for a person that holds an administrative, supervisory, or instructional leadership roles. And this would not require rulemaking. Section 14 is the annual public report, and requires that the report be approved by the board of directors and lists what the annual report include. Section 15 is the review and comment that sponsors provide a written evaluation of their school's performance and that they submit it to the commissioner. Paragraph B allows a sponsor to assess a fee and requires that agreed upon fee structure to be stated in the charter school contract. The fee is defined in paragraph C, and that fee is the greater of the basic formula allowance or the lesser of a maximum fee factor times the basic allowance. So it sets the minimum at basic formula allowance of 5124 and sets the maximum at 5124 times a number that begins at 1.5 in fiscal year 10 and goes up to 4.0 in fiscal year 2013 and later. And then requires that fee be 1% of the basic formula allowance for that year times the charter school's adjusted marginal cost pupil units subject to that minimum and maximum. Paragraph D requires that the department not assess a fee to the charter schools it sponsors. And paragraph C requires the sponsors to submit to the commissioner a statement of expenditures of their sponsoring activities. And that, I believe, is different from how it left subcommittee. Section 16 is the lease space provision, and it includes a requirement that the department review and approve or disapprove the lease agreement within 60 days of receiving an application for lease aid. Section 17 is new language that would allow a charter school to organize a nonprofit building corporation. They must first file a supplementary affidavit and get approval from the commissioner before they organize this nonprofit building corporation. And then paragraph B, and this is slightly different from how it left the subcommittee, it requires that if the charter school wants to purchase or renovate an existing facility, that the charter school had operated for at least 3 consecutive years and not in statutory operating debt. And then in paragraph C at the top of page 18, if the charter school wants to form a nonprofit building corporation for the purposes of building a school, then the charter school must have operated for at least 8 consecutive years and not be in statutory operating debt. And the two paragraphs B and C list what the sponsor shall submit in the supplemental affidavit. And those criteria are the same except for on line 18.12, the supplemental affidavit for a nonprofit building corporation for the purposes of building a building has to also include the lack of other documentation of the lack of other existing facilities that could be renovated or purchased. Section 18 was a provision that was included in last year's policy bill, I believe, and it limits the time by which a district may require a request that a teacher request a leave or the extension of a leave to a charter school, and also defines who pays into the Teachers Retirement Association. It was a little bit confusing there, and so language is stricken, and then it's inserted on 18.31 that teachers continue to aggregate benefits according to chapters 354 and 354A. Section 19 goes into the causes for renewal and termination of a charter school contract, and paragraph A allows is the language for the sponsors not renewing a contract at the end of a school at the end of a term. Paragraph B defines why the contract can be terminated, and then paragraph C deals with if the charter school and the charter school sponsor want to mutually agree to terminate or not renew a contract, this is the process by which they can do that. And paragraph D allows the commissioner to terminate a contract between a sponsor and a charter school for sustained failure to meet pupil performance requirements, financial mismanagement, or failure to meet generally accepted standards of financial management. And three allows the commissioner to terminate a contract for repeated or major violations of the law. I think when this left committee or the subcommittee, there was also another three read repeated violations of the law and four read other good cause shown, and this was changed to read repeated or major violations of the law. Section 20 lists definitions for related party, affiliate, close relative, person, and control. And these were definitions, although slightly changed, they were defined in subdivision 26, and they're just reinserted here, and subdivision 26 is repealed later. Section 21 is specifies the amount of tort liability limits that a charter school must hold, and requires the charter school board to submit a copy of the insurance policy to the sponsor and commissioner, and then also requires them to submit changes in its insurance carrier or policy to the sponsor and commissioner within 20 business days of the change. Section 22 is the business lease aid section, and this breaks apart the lease aid for in paragraph B for a charter school without a separate affiliated nonprofit building corporation, in paragraph C for charter schools with a separate affiliated nonprofit building corporation. The amount of lease aid in section B and section C is the same amount. They're just broken up into two different paragraphs. Section 23 was language from the department that requested that charter schools not be paid the 10% up front, but instead they be paid 24 equal payments throughout the year. Formerly, they were paid 10% up front and then 23 equal payments later. I think the reasoning here was that they received startup money from the state and startup money from the federal government, and so this would even it out, although the department can probably comment on why that was done later. Paragraph C requires that charter schools that allows the commissioner to withhold state aid if the charter school fails to comply with the directive to return for cause federal or state funds. Paragraph C allows the commissioner to withhold state aid if the charter school fails to pay a school district, intermediate school district, education cooperative, or the state after receiving an undisputed invoice for goods or services. And then Section 24 requires the commissioner to approve at least one but no more than two charitable organizations by June 30th, 2011. And then this was added from the subcommittee report. And then Section 25 is the repealer, and it repeals Subdivision 18, which is allows the charter school to I'll have to look it up. It was outdated language that the department suggested. It's working capital. Section 19 allows the charter school to disseminate information, and that was to certain groups, and that's repealed. And Section 26 is that those definition sections that I discussed earlier.
Senator Salzman, it looks like that working group spent a lot of time and energy in this. Members, have you got Senator Bonnock questions?
Mr. Chair, and first, before I say anything, Senator Saltzman, I want to acknowledge the work that you've done on this, the leadership you provided for our working group, as well as your openness and hearing from so many different people who had such differing points of view, and your ability to listen to all of that and bring forward a compromise in many of the key provisions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff.
A couple of the provisions I just wanted to point to specifically. I know that in our subcommittee, members were very concerned about the cap on putting a charter school too close to a school district or locating it too soon after a school district closed. And so I want to just point out that the way you addressed that was by allowing the commissioner to waive that requirement. And I think that is a compromise. And so I appreciate seeing that in there, because that was one of the sections I was concerned about. I also appreciated the compromise with regard to non-sectarian, because I was also concerned about some of our higher quality sponsors might not be allowed to continue playing that role, and so I appreciate that. One of the areas I was concerned about had to do with governance, and for those who were on the subcommittee, they know that I particularly focused on this area in almost every subcommittee meeting, so it would be inconsistent for me now not to bring that back up again. And just to give the members a flavor of what this is about, the legislative auditor spent a great deal of time focusing on that some of the problems that our current charter schools have had to do with how the boards were set up, and that the way we established our governance rules probably weren't the best possible way they could have been structured. For example, we had said in earlier law that our boards had to have a teacher majority. And when you think about that, that was literally saying that employees, in every case, had to be the ultimate decider on policy and could overrule a board chair or other board members. And so the compromise Senator Saltzman put forward in this says that it doesn't have to be a teacher majority. I would even advocate one step farther, and did so in the subcommittee, to say that it's really never appropriate for there to be a teacher majority on the board. I think it's critical that they have a voice on the board and that they are an integral part of designing how these charter schools function. But my concern when you have a teacher majority is that if you think about a board of directors as an oversight arm to oversee what's happening in the school, and yet who the board oversees are the very people that are the majority of the board, it just seems like an inconsistency that isn't good governance. And I understand that in some cases teachers really are running the entire thing and they're doing a phenomenal job, but I would distinguish that as being management versus the ultimate oversight role of the board. I do think that what you offered was a compromise, and I know that people in the audience agree with your compromise, but I did just want to raise it as something that I didn't agree with. Thanks.
Senator Saltzman.
Here. And on that point, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the dialogue we've had on this. And on page 58 of the Legislative Auditor's Report, which is dated June of 2008, it is noted that the recommendation does not prohibit a teacher majority on the board. And so while the Legislative Auditor did note that we should not require it and there is the potential, we left that in. And as you noted, Senator Bonoff, there are schools that operate extremely well. I would hesitate to disrupt that. And so I think we're coming quite a ways from requiring it to not requiring it, to go from requiring it to actually prohibiting it might be farther than we want to go. Certainly, this bill is still a work in progress. I acknowledge that. But I think we've reached a really good compromise here. But we have also reflected that teachers and parents and also community members are really key to building support and building a stronger community. Actually, in the Chicago model, they require stakeholder meetings with the communities as part of the chartering process, that you have to reach out to all these groups. And so I think that this is a good place there. So
Mr. Chair and Senator Saltzman, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And again, thank you for the consensus building work.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment on one specific language issue in here on page 14. It just really jumped out at me with the amendment that you're changing the ability of a charter school in a specific geographic area, and it says on line 10 and 11, it says residents of a specific geographic area when the school serves low-income students at risk of academic failure. And I just keep thinking in my mind, I can see the sign on the school for academic failures. I don't like that term, and I don't think we should put that in statute, and I don't think we should. I think we need to rethink about what we mean there.
Senator Saltzman.
I appreciate the question because we had some dialogue, and maybe Mr. Piccolo could join me for this. Senator Hahn brought this up at our last meeting in that we had struck the language there, and this was in response to the fact that there's been some discussion about whether with some federal law, and I'll have Mr. Piccolo discuss that, if we could do this. And yet, as you notice here, this is under a section where a charter school may limit admission, and so we do have at least one charter school that wants to sort of be in a neighborhood and draw a line around a school and say, we'd like to focus on this neighborhood. And the intent is not about race. It's about we want to serve children who are at risk. And that instead of having an open enrollment policy of just anyone can come, we'd really like to serve this particular community. So it seemed that we needed to define why are we allowing a school to draw a boundary. And this seemed to be good language in that it wasn't just at risk of act. And, you know, when you look at the charter schools law and you look at why we really initiate this and why President Obama is really promoting charter schools is to target kids who are at risk of academic failure. So we're sort of giving this in this provision, we're giving them another sort of exemption if they really want to target a specific area. So, Mr. Piccolo, maybe you could help address this.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I understand the intent of what you're doing here, and I'm not arguing with the intent. I just don't like the terminology. I think we need to change the terminology, frankly, because it sort of labels kids before they even get there. And I think maybe, we could say it in a more positive way. That's all I'm asking.
Senator Rummel first, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This non-functioning microphone, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Senator Saltzman, would you consider language such as a traditionally underserved population?
No. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is I'm wondering if we could, if people are willing, and I think I've shown over the past 2 weeks I'm really willing to work on stakeholders, if we could perhaps work on this language. I think we came a long way in that we had something where we were going to perhaps not allow this, to really trying to recognize this. And this was an attempt to get the issue back on the table that we need to define why we're doing it. I'd be very open to that. I'm not sure we could wordsmith here for quite a while, but I understand your intent. I'm just trying to get the point out. Why would we allow this? Because we are targeting a specific group of students.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that does offer another option, and maybe if you could distribute A15, maybe that would give some clarity, or if that's satisfactory, or if it's not, we'll keep going.
Before Senator Olson offers her amendment, Senator Saltzman moves the A9 amendment that you have before you. That hasn't been moved. So on Senator Saltzman's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. And Senator Olson still has the Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, the A15 amendment does remove, let's see here, it's 10-11.
Maybe, Mr. Chair.
So students, yeah, it deals with that very provision, and it just takes a different approach to that language, and it's where the average student performance is determined under Section 120B35 Subdivision 1 is below statewide average student performance, and the school reflects the racial and ethnic diversity of the specific area. Okay. I don't know if that's any better or worse, but it's there for your consideration.
On that, Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I like it a lot better. I was thinking, I mean, I don't know if Senator Rummel's shaking her heads. I was thinking, or not meeting academic progress or standards or something like that. I'm not sure about the other parts of the amendment.
Senator Rummel.
Mr. Chair and committee, imagine a child going to a school that's been classified as one that's serving students that are below the state average. I mean, it's just like in a classroom where you have some children that need special services. We work so hard not to get them categorized either by their performance. I think we need something more generic that gets at the point without categorizing. I mean, I can imagine kids who, I don't want to go to that school. That's a school for dummies. So that's I think that's what we're trying to get at, is that however we classify this, it doesn't somehow make kids feel less capable.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm trying to reflect on the exact reason that we're doing this. Remember, public schools are public schools, and we've got a subcommittee out that's looking at integration and all of the issues related to integration. So I don't think we want to. I think, Senator Rummel, you have a point. Senator Hand.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess to this discussion, and I appreciate, Sir Saltzman, you're trying to address this. We did have some discussion about this, and what it does reflect is that there are some charter schools that have taken upon themselves the mission of trying to bring the performance of a specific neighborhood group of kids to be better. That's been their mission. And they wanted to do that without running the risk of attracting students from a broader area that might not have the same needs. And so this language was a way to facilitate them drawing an enrollment area. And so it's not that this is labeling a school. It is defining an enrollment area, and that is the key thing. And I think that there are many parents who are, as they're being asked to consider enrolling their student in a school, they're very interested in knowing, can you help my child, perform better than what he's currently or she's currently doing. And so this as a mission is often very specifically a part of a charter school's mission. They have the goal of raising performance among kids who have not been performing well at this point. That's written in a number of the charter school contracts, if you will. So this is not about defining a school. It's about defining the enrollment area to allow the school to fulfill its mission. And so the
The current language that's in the law is kind of clunky, and it was eliminated, I think, because of that. And I appreciate Senator Saltzman's trying to get at that by her language. I think Senator Olson's language does that well too. But I think the idea is important to preserve. And so, however we do this, I just would argue that we need to do it.
Senator Hand, one of the issues that has brought some of this legislation, certainly not all of it, but some of it, was this very problem is that, you know, since charter schools are public schools, and some of them have taken on kind of a complexion of monolithic schools, I think that it also is in conflict with lines 14.21 to 14. If you look at a charter school shall 14.23. A charter school may not limit admissions to to pupils on the basis of intellectual ability, measures of achievement or aptitude, or athletic ability. I'm still be after that pretty soon, but and may not establish any criteria or requirements for admissions. So, I mean, we put in one place that you can do it because they live in a certain neighborhood, and then here, two, three sentences later, you have the exact opposite.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I would say that those speak to two different things. If you look at the admissions, I think, requirements of charter schools, they do not in any way conflict with the language you just referred to. There is not you can only attend the charter school under these conditions of performance or aptitude, or there's nothing like that. But what they are saying is they locate the school in a particular part of a city, and they say, in this area, in this neighborhood, there are lots of kids that have great needs. Let's serve these kids. But if you don't have the ability to define that enrollment area, you could very well attract kids from a much broader geographic area that may not fit in with the mission of the school, which is to try to help kids that need help. And so I think that it's not an admissions thing, because if you're in that neighborhood, whatever you can go. But what they are trying to do is to allow their enrollment area to be consistent with the mission that they're trying to facilitate. And I think it's a very good mission, and people are attracted to it. And it's one of the reasons why charter schools have had such significant growth, when many of the other traditional public schools are not. And I think that to not facilitate the mission of the charter schools to do this would be a destructive thing. And however, whatever the language is, I think Senator Saltzman's language is fine. I appreciate the comment about maybe not using academic failure. I think Senator Olson's language might be a little better. But however we do it, I think we need to do it.
Okay. Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chairman, I concur with Senator Hand's statements, and appreciate Senator Saltzman's proposed language. I think the discussion in the subcommittee revolved around the complexity of putting in all the language, whether non-Caucasian and what kind of, you know, ethnicity. And we as a subcommittee felt pretty strongly that we wanted to stay away from that and move instead towards a focus on achievement. And so I think Senator Saltzman gracefully put forward, I had actually put ** good next to it, because I think she very gracefully inserted some language that took out that focus and placed a focus on achievement. I'm now sensitive to what Senator Anderson said, and so I trust that Senator Saltzman will go back and find a way to address that. But I think that when we've seen these charter schools that are serving these at-risk populations and doing so in a very profound and positive way, that we want to continue to allow that to flourish rather than limit it.
Senator Saltzman.
So just, you know, perhaps the bigger issue here, Mr. Chair, is whether or not we want to allow any school to define their enrollment boundaries, because charter schools do not have boundaries. There's not preference given. And so this is here specifically to say, when would we allow a charter school to create a boundary? And so it's defined as why we think that's important. I know that when I struck this, There were representatives here from Senator Torres Ray's district and Hiawatha Leadership Academy, and they used this provision specifically and felt it really it is serving that community very well. So I think that's the larger decision. I'd very willing to work on it with people as this bill moves through the process to find either better words or, I guess, you know, to hear from the committee, do we even want to allow it for any purpose? That's, I think, the bigger issue.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Salzman. I'm quite sensitive to the use of words, although if we are to review the books and really look at the use of words in all of the books that we have in there, we'll have multiple corrections that we'll have to do, really. And so I'm not so sure that we need to have language that is so specific in these matters. However, I am sensitive to the fact that we often put together the words poverty and risk, and I am quite offended by that. I don't think that we should do that, especially with children. So I do have a problem with that. And Senator Salzman, I do have a suggestion because I do believe that the intent here is really to look at academic performance more than anything else, and I think that's a great thing. So maybe we should say when the school serves students who are in need of support to improve academic performance. That will include anybody, whether that person is poor, middle class, black, white, Latino. And so I would like to suggest that we put that language in there.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to try one more suggestion, and then that's probably hopefully my last word on this. What about just saying when the school serves low-income students and is focused on raising student achievement in that student population? I just want to say it in a positive rather than saying there's something wrong with these kids, saying that the school is here to try to make things better for those kids. That's all I'm getting at. And maybe we can put that language in there as a placeholder and let Senator Saltzman continue to work it out. But I would feel much more comfortable if we switched it around to a more positive statement.
Mr. Chair, I think...
So I'll work on this, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to work on it. But if this is not to a specific population of students, I think we should strike the whole paragraph. Because if it becomes too broad, then we're opening a different dialogue about any charter school could say, well, I'm serving, and they become neighborhoods. And that's a different discussion that we haven't had. So I think that we'll have a discussion. If we can't find language, we just strike the entire paragraph. And I'm trying to accommodate, actually, a school in Senator Torres Ray's community, and these were the words that were suggested to me. So I'm not, they're not my words. They were words that were suggested in trying to define this population. So I'm sorry if people find them offensive.
That's
not my intent.
Let's do this. This legislation does have to go to state and local government, so we do need to take some action on it to get it there. And I think Senator Anderson, Senator Torres Ray, Senator Olson all have suggestions, and I think maybe the idea would be to work with those so that we can get you can get the language the way you know, would be acceptable.
Could I just offer,
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I frankly didn't have much problem with the way you had it. But can I suggest, since the sensitivity on the low income is to delete low income and that it serves students reflective of the area that are at risk of, now if you want to do something with the academic failure too, find something that's softer. But you're not advertising or putting the name of the school on that says that, but that's just kind of reflective of what their mission is. I wouldn't have any problem, but you wouldn't have to, if they are reflective of the area, that would accommodate the low income without saying it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's several suggestions out there that you can work with.
Thank you.
Any other questions that we have? One that I have that goes back to... I think it's on page 22. Why did you divide the separate affiliated nonprofit from the a charter school without a separate affiliated nonprofit from a charter school with a separate affiliated nonprofit?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to address that. One of the discussions that is still going on, and this is actually probably more of an issue for us to discuss as a finance issue, is that there have been a number of questions raised, including from, you know, we've talked with the department, we've talked with various groups, about if we're going to now allow an affiliated building corporation, which right now is sort of this vague area, and the legislative auditor's report in 2003 did note that, you know, we could call it a loophole, but, you know, charter schools were never intended to own buildings. And so the fact that there are now these building corporations and lease aid is being used and buildings are being purchased or being constructed, sort of a gray area. So really tried to work on this. But through this, there's been a number of discussions of if you are buying a building, should there be a different way of determining lease aid? This bill, as it's written, is identical. But it is a placeholder to recognize that we've had some of those discussions on how lease aid is determined. One of the questions that has been brought up, and I know that there's members in the House working on this, is that, you know, a school district, when you have a building bond, you bond and your taxpayers put in for a certain number of years, and they pay off the building. And when it's paid off, the bonds are paid off, taxpayers stop paying. The school district, it's like the faucet is turned off. And so with a charter school, and many of them are very new in terms of buying building, is that after the building is paid for, the bonds are paid off, and this is down the road here, should the lease aid continue? Because the bonds have been paid off. Is there a different formula? And there's been some discussion on that. The department has told me that they would like to continue having this discussion. Whether or not we address this year in the future, that those are some of the questions. There's also been questions in terms of, you know, it's a flat fee. It's pretty much a flat fee. Should there be other formulas used? So the fact that we are now in this bill now allowing at least recognizing that charter schools can have a building corporation, and we're allowing that to happen under certain stipulations, that we also recognize that in terms of how we might look at lease aid, and not necessarily this year. And obviously lease aid is of great concern to charter schools. That's an issue that I know we'll be taking up as part of our budget process.
Senator Saltzman, was there any discussion with the Department of Administration over the whole issue of leases and I know I've sat in on a number of those discussions in the Capital Investment Committee where leases we lease a lot of buildings. And we purchase and we build a lot of buildings, the state does. And the Department of Administration has, you know, has their opinions because they manage everything, what the best approach is. Because, you know, the state does have an investment, whether it's through leases or whether it's through ownership or whether it's, you know, some combination. And, you know, that's, I think, one thing that I have thought of, too, is that, right now, we have a commercial real estate bubble that is. We have a lot of facilities around. I mean, empty, and I think I don't know if those lease contracts reflect the current market value or last year's or 10 years ago, or what. And so. I think that is an issue that we should discuss because we, the state taxpayers, should not be paying you know, 200% of the current lease value if the lease value is less. Again, the other direction, if inflation comes along and the leases go up, that then the state should would reflect that increase.
Those are excellent questions, Mr. Chair. And we started to get into this, and we could have had another working group formed on that issue. And I'm very happy to follow through on that because I think there are some really good ways. I do know that, again, when I've sort of looked across the country at what other states are doing, that in many cases, you know, in some states, of course, their funding formulas are different, do not provide lease aid at all, provide significantly less than we do here in Minnesota. And the other issue here that this is another sort of controversial issue, but I think we need to acknowledge it, is that as over time, charter schools have become very popular, and one of the things I'd like to do is really bring our charter school and our public district school district sector closer together. And some of the bills I have sponsored are looking at how we help our district schools, you know, provide innovation. Is that when a charter school uses a public school district, that building has already been paid for with taxpayer dollars. And the children who are going in are likely from that community. So, you know, should we consider looking at a different formula because that school building is a public facility? I know that's probably not a real popular thing to bring up with school districts, but I'm, you know, trying to be open here and looking at this from a very broad perspective. Or, you know, we also see models across the country. That's a piece that's also in this bill in the advisory committee, is that we'd like to have them recommend some models of how we really improve communication, also cooperation between charter schools and district schools, both in communities and throughout the state. So I think there's a number of issues here, and I'd be happy to work on them.
Okay. And I, Mr. Piccolo, do you want to make some comments?
Sure. Senator Chairman Stump and members, I think just to let you know that we have worked closely with the working group and Senator Saltzman's leadership in it. And, you know, there are provisions, I think, that we support in here. We've supported the reforms that the legislative auditor, and I think it does reflect all the issues that the legislative auditor made recommendations on, and we've been supportive of these changes in terms of raising accountability and transparency of charter schools for at least 3 years in our work. And there are things in here that obviously we believe are very good, and there's a couple things we obviously don't like in here, but I think there's been a spirit of cooperation and working together to try to find solutions to these issues. In terms of the building companies, we have taken a position that we are open to the idea that when the bonds are paid off for these buildings that schools have purchased through affiliated companies, that there should be a reduction in lease aid. But that is an issue, and we're working with Representative in the House, Representative Morgan in the House, and Mr. Kite from the Superintendents Association, to try to find some language to address some of these things.
Mr. Bass, Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I might note also on lines 1515 through 1527, this is regarding some additional addressing some of the issues that have been brought forward regarding charter school administrators. And some of the proposals that were brought to us, and some of them were brought to us from charter school directors, who supported the fact that should every charter school have a licensed principal? I mean, this was coming from, you know, people who are on the front line of charter schools, and that seemed maybe going a little bit too far. So in my first attempt, it was, could we create a special a charter school administrative licensure? In other words, to accommodate, not to, you know, for anyone to have to lose their job, but a process in place to address some of the issues. And Mr. Piccolo has been extremely generous in helping to draft the language that is there. And I know Mr. Nathan is here as well, and he would speak in favor of this particular piece. It is not intended to target people who are currently in administrative levels in charter schools, but to acknowledge that, you know, professional development is important. And if we're giving the flexibility again to a charter school to not have to meet these particular requirements, that is there some process in place to ensure that, because this is an area where As we've seen some of the news stories that are very troubling to the public of mismanagement, you know, close to fraud, some of these areas that we'd like to make sure we don't see those headlines again, making sure that we have the kind of leadership in our charter schools where sometimes just additional having a, you know, plan would be helpful. So, Mr. Piccolo, I don't know if you want to note that, but I really do appreciate his help in drafting this language.
I think all of us realize that education doesn't end once we leave school. Mm-hmm. It continues our whole lifetime. So, Mr. Piccolo?
Senator Stump, members, I think the way we work this language is to recognize the unique characteristics of charter schools. That one of the principles of charter schools in this law is that in exchange for freedom from some of the rules and regulations that apply to traditional districts, that charter schools have to create their own standards and be held accountable to those. So this language says every school needs to do that, and there is a process there for holding it accountable in terms of the professional development of its staff by putting it in the annual report to the public and to the commissioner and to their sponsor.
Okay, Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the work on that. That was an issue that in our subcommittee was a challenge, and I think we should not forget that charter schools were created to be these islands of innovation and freedom from some of the regulatory structures that are in the current traditional schools, and I just would urge us to be cautious about imposing too many trying to make the charters like the traditional schools. That's not the point. We don't want to make them like the schools. We want to give them freedom to be different, and so we should try to be a little careful about that. But I appreciate the change that was done in the administrative things, and I think that may be workable. I did want to go back, though, and just talk a little bit about this lease and the building corporations and get some clarification on specifically Section 17. And is there anybody from one of the building corporations that can talk about that? I do have a concern about that you need to be in a business for 8 years before you can do this. And do we have anybody that could maybe give us an insight from that perspective of whether this is workable?
So perhaps, Mr. Chair, if I could just address that while someone comes up, is that in the other proposals, I think that there was a defined year of 5 or 7 years before you could form a building company. So I think I've really moved to go from 5 to 7 to 3 years to use an existing facility has really recognized that we'd like to encourage charter schools to use existing facilities. The reason we have 8 years, Senator Hand, is that charter schools go through a charter renewal process at 3 years and then again at 5 years. And so the 8 years was chosen because by then they've gone through their second renewal. And that seemed to be that if you're going to be, you know, building a building, that having that after 8 years, you've got a good track record. And you've passed that second renewal process. So that seemed to be very, very reasonable. And so there was some thought. There was a very thoughtful process as to why that was. And the thing is that I think that, you know, I've talked with the department, and, you know, there's still some, and I have some, you know, some letters here from charter schools about when we put too much emphasis on facilities, that we really start detracting from why there are charter schools. I mean, I know of one charter school that, you know, has made a comment, in order to compete in our community, we need an equal facility. Well, charter schools are, you know, really, their competition is their program. And certainly we want to, you know, provide for facilities, but at the same time, there's an issue here of fiscal responsibility to the taxpayers. And as Senator Stump said, you know, the number of students in Minnesota is not going to be growing for a while, and we have adequate space in our current schools. So there may be a transition over time of charter schools either co-locating or replacing schools that are there, and we're trying to deal with that as well. So I think this is a pretty good compromise with that.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment that I want to offer, and I know we're getting short on time, but I really do appreciate the hard work that Senator Saltzman has put in here, and as I reflect over the things that we've been trying to do and that you are working on, is to not lose sight of the purpose of improving student learning, student achievement, and providing for the creativity of that, as well as along with it to have some fiscal accountability, that we're using our resources wisely. There's just a provision in here that doesn't deal with that, and I would like to offer 0261. And that is on page 8. I appreciate that you have removed the moratorium. I suspect that that's got to be out of respect for President Obama and Secretary Duncan of not putting caps on charter schools, and he's been speaking rather emphatically about that. But the provisions from line 27 through 35 and on 9, 1 through 5, I think just kind of go against the issue of working toward student achievement. I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that charter schools can't be created overnight. And I think some of the provisions and changes that we've made actually may even slow that down a bit. That at least 18 months to 2 years is required now to get a quality school organization and operation up and running. And so I would just respectfully ask that this section be removed as well. Maybe, and Mr. Piccolo would like to speak to it as well.
But first, Mr. Chair, if I could speak to this.
Sure. Yes, I know a situation, Senator Olson, in my district where provision, where a school board was facing a budget problem and had to close one of its schools, and the community was up in arms and threatened the school board, if you close this school, we're going to open a charter school. And so it creates a tough scenario when you have a board to make, you know, they have to run a financially sound school board. It was a difficult decision. I mean, this is not an easy decision at all. But
Mr. Chair, can I just respond to that? It's easy to say we're going to open a charter school. It's a little bit more work than that to do it. And I think, you know, the reaction of parents to that, if the school district has been delivering a service well, I think they ought to be making the case that they want to maintain the quality and the perspective of programs that they've been able to give to students, and that building. I mean, I think there's a strong case that can be made rather than just a reaction that we have to get on a defensive mode. I don't think some of those will happen. And that just because a few of them get hot under the collar and try to threaten.
I'm just reflecting that.
Yeah.
This provision probably would cover it.
Well, if Senator I could just respond, Mr. Chair. I know this is a controversial position, and I want to go back to the fact that this bill, I have tried to listen to many different stakeholder groups, and I think it would be I don't want to use it irresponsible, but I just think that we need to acknowledge the situations that school districts face in some situations. And they're not based on necessarily anything to do with how parents feel about their child's experience. They may love the school that is closing, but because of changes in demographics that have nothing to do with the performance of that school district, that school districts are making very, very difficult decisions. And this has been referred to as a cooling off period. It's an opportunity for a community that, if anyone at this table has been through a consolidation or closing of a school, and I've worked very hard to try to find language, and I am still open to working on better language, but this is where we're at as of today. We've acknowledged that it does not limit a school district to, encouraging a school to come into an area. And I believe that, you know, we've been, you know, very clear that a charter school is not to be authorized to replace, you know, a school that has closed. So we're giving the commissioner the authority to determine that, which I think is a very, very good next step. But I think to not recognize at all what happens when a school district, because we want them to make good fiscal decisions, and they're very painful, and to then say, you close the school. I know Dr. Kite is here as well, I believe, and he speaks to this, Mr. Walseth and Mr. Grathwald and Mr. Kroonquist. We could have a whole group up here talking about this as well.
We might have to list.
Mr. Chairman.
One of the other things that I'd like to do is, and we won't be able to do it during the session, but is to look at the governance of our schools and the options that that should be available, because and it goes back quite a ways. Joe Graba and the era of prior to the current memberships in the legislature. But many of our small schools, we saw this with Senator Dill's bill, where we had three school districts trying to figure out how in the world they could get together, but they had some debt, and the facilities were terrible. We have those situations all over greater Minnesota, and we need to take a look as a legislative body. I think we need to take a look at creating some new options to allow these districts to function in a more up-to-date manner. And some of that means, looking at facilities, how they're funded or how they're not funded. And I'd like to do that over the interim. And I think another one that came before this committee was the Brooklyn Center, the community schools. There's a lot of potential, I think, for some communities to have community schools that address their given geographic area. And so there's some things that charter schools fill a huge, void. So I mean, I'm just saying that that's what I'd like to do in this upcoming over the interim. So Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think your story you brought up made a good point about an undesirable situation, and I'm just wondering, how did that end up? Did your school board close the school, and did the parents open up the charter school?
It took time. The first time they did it, they kept the school open. And then the second time, I think they actually were forced because of the financial implications. They had to close the school.
So they did close the school.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, then did the parents open up the charter school?
No, they didn't. What happened is the students, like so many places in greater Minnesota, went in about three different directions to the neighboring school districts. And that shouldn't really, I mean, that's very difficult for parents, children. We need to find a better solution than that. And, of course, the open enrollment process allows that to happen. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I support Senator Olson's amendment. In fact, I had an identical amendment drawn up under my name. So, and we did have some discussion about this in the subcommittee. But I think, and she's made the point, that it takes a long time to get these going. And I don't want us to get focused on how can we preserve the existing school districts. That should not be our focus. Our focus should be on how do we provide education opportunities for all kids. And charter schools have that niche. It's a growing niche. We should try to find ways to facilitate that. I am troubled by the language. If you look on lines 8.3 and I think in paragraph L as well, similar language, but that you can only do it if the traditional school board district gives permission to the charter school. I think that's a hugely problematic construction in law when we already know that there are some tensions between charters and publics, and to put in law that you can only do something with the permission of the one school, I think is really troubling. So I support Senator Olson's amendment, and I would urge that we would adopt it.
Okay, Senator Saltz or Senator Bonhoff?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hahn, I just also wanted to point out that there is the other possible way to not have that be enacted is the commissioner can waive it. So it's not just the school district. You're also allowing the commissioner to. So, as you know, I was concerned about that provision in the committee, but I went to Senator Saltzman and discussed it. And so, given the waiver of the commissioner, I was more open to go that. But I just wanted to follow up on one thing that you said, Mr. Chairman. When you talked about the governance model and the importance of working in the interim, I concur with you. And I just want you to know that that's actually part of the intent behind the controversial shared services bill, is that section of the bill that talks about the consultant working with the school districts. It is my thought that that's exactly what they would be looking at, is how can we look at our governance and in as wide and flexible way as possible. And so I agree.
We do need to move on, Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just would call your attention to the testimony in writing from Eric Mahmoud from the Harvest Prep Academy addressing this issue, too. I mean, there's a number of schools within a mile, and he's within a mile of schools that might close or, that, and is showing his performance record. So it's, I think that it wouldn't close his, it would close an opportunity that might well serve that that neighborhood. I'd like to bring it to a vote, but could you clarify, Senator Saltzman, on page 9, line 4, where the commissioner must use the criteria in this section? All of this law is amending one section, 124D, 0.10. What do you mean by that? Is it referring to one specific area, or is it the criteria? Is the whole law the criteria, or what are you talking about?
Senator Saltzman.
On that point, Senator Olson and Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Ms. McQuay if you could refer, because we worked on this. Would you be able to help me with that, Ms. McQuay?
Ms. McQuay?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, the intent was that it wouldn't waive the requirements for the formation of the school or the requirements the forming of a sponsor. It wouldn't waive the entire section. It would just waive those two paragraphs.
So Mr. Chair and Ms. McQuay, that would cover all of the just that they had gone through an appropriate application process and would be an adequate school to be approved by any count.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that was the intent.
Call the question.
Senator Saltzman, and then we'll take a vote on this.
So just to close, Mr. Chair, this is not a black and white issue. There is room within the language here that allows for an appeal process, and certainly I am willing to look at better language. The thing that's been difficult on this, it's sort of been we have a moratorium or we don't. I think I have moved way over the 50-yard line on this one to try to address issues with all of our schools in our public sector. So that's and I believe children are well served.
Senator Olson, we want to vote on this.
Okay.
The intent is once we vote on this amendment, we're going to lay your bill on the table, and then we'll recess until 3 o'clock. On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
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 Voted twice.
Motion does not prevail.
Division.
All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed, raise your hand. Motion does not prevail, 5-11.
Oh.
Committee is recessed until 3 o'clock. Oh, wait, we need your motion. Motion to lay it on
I'd
the
like
table.
To lay the bill on the table
on
at this
Senator
time,
Saltzman's
Mr. Chair.
Motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, the same sign. Motion is adopted. Committee is recessed. Please put your papers in your file.
Yeah. Why don't you double check?